In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. What would have been inside the medieval first aid kit? What were the most curious cures of the era? And is it true that it was better to steer clear of the doctor altogether in the Middle Ages? Speaking to Emily Briffitt, Elmer Brenner answers your top questions about medieval medical theory and practice, from how gruesome surgery was to whether leeches were really that useful.
Hi, Elmer. Thank you so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we are going to be delving into the world of medieval medicine. And I think the first question is probably the one we need to ask the most. And that's, on average, was it actually better to go to the medieval doctor than it was to not?
It's a good question. I think it relates to how we think about our health today as well, particularly with having a health service that is kind of there available for us to use. It would really depend on what was wrong with you and what kind of access you had to medical practitioners. So if you were very ill, sadly, and if, for example, you had a severe infection, there probably wasn't a great deal that a medieval physician could do for you. At the same time, there was a lot of really good advice that a physician could give you about how to stay healthy and prevent yourself from getting into a state of severe illness. And this related to diets and exercise and other aspects of lifestyle. And so it's kind of tied to that kind of balancing act between avoiding illness and dealing with illness when it comes along. The other thing I'd say is that, and I think this is definitely the case today, a medical practitioner could give you reassurance. So, for example, if you were really worried that you were very ill, you might go to them and describe your symptoms, and they could actually tell you that, I think you're probably okay, or you're going to be okay. Or if they did diagnose something that they considered to be quite serious, they could offer you strategies to cope with that. So I think overall it was worth visiting a medical practitioner if you could have access to one, but they definitely couldn't solve all the medical issues that people faced.
While we're on this note, I think there is this really common perception that medieval medicine perhaps wasn't as useful, maybe a bit more dangerous than helpful. Sharon Gork on Facebook has asked about the mortality rates in the medieval period. And she's asked, how do mortality rates compare with modern medicine?
So it's a great question. And I think it would be really, really interesting to be able to answer it fully. It's difficult to answer it because it's really difficult to compare mortality rates in the two periods and also to compare the different kinds of issues that would cause people to die. So in the Middle Ages, obviously I've already talked about infection as being something that could very easily kill you. From the middle of the 14th century, you have recurrent outbreaks of plague, which was very deadly, and obviously is probably the issue that people think about most immediately when they think about medieval mortality. Something that's very interesting, though, particularly when you look at archaeological remains, is evidence that people did live with long-term health conditions that were potentially quite debilitating. A range of disabilities and chronic conditions that got worse. Leprosy would be an example of that, where it's a very serious condition that affects people for a number of years, and their skeletal remains will show that, and it will show that they were living with it and that they didn't necessarily in the end die from leprosy, but they died from a complication associated with it. So overall, it is difficult to compare. I think there are lots of standout issues that we could think about, such as the risk of mortality in childbirth. But equally, we could think about modern life and statistics about issues that people face in modern life and modern day health risks, such as smoking, for example, that were not there in the medieval period.
Now, I think before we delved in too deep, we should probably do a little bit of setup. Could you tell us about the core beliefs surrounding medieval medical practice?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important thing to think about because these ideas were very ubiquitous. So they were held by people who were educated in medicine at universities, but also much more widely than that, in domestic settings, in local communities. And these ideas were core principles about how the body functioned. And so the key idea, above all, was about the humours, which were four fluids in the body that needed to be in balance for a person to be healthy. The fluids were blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. And the concept of the humours, which came from ancient medicine, was accompanied by another ancient concept, the non-naturals, which were a set of variable factors that affected health. And these were some of the issues that I've already mentioned a bit that very much tie in with lifestyle. So what you eat, how much you exercise, how much sleep you get, the retention of things in your body, as well as the air that you breathe and the emotional ups and downs that you experience as well. And there was also a real awareness of the macrocosm, the broader environment, both on Earth in terms of the four elements, so the earth, the air, the fire and water, and also on an astrological plane, so the movements of the planets and how those would affect health as well.
Now, were these ideas commonly upheld, or was there any resistance or perhaps hesitation to accept these ideas?
Humoral medicine is interesting because it was the key mechanism for diagnosis. So, for example, a physician might inspect a person's urine and look at its colour and maybe even smell it and say something about the balance of the humours in the body. And that person might go away and say, might be a bit sceptical if, for example, they'd experienced an accident at work a few weeks previously and they had a sense that what was causing their pain, their suffering, was not to do with their humoral balance, but was actually to do with something external that had happened to their body. And it's clear that in some instances, there was thinking along those lines that was sceptical. At the same time, the construct of the humours was very persuasive because in that instance that I've just mentioned, maybe that person's in conversation with their physician and the physician would say, well, what happened here is that the accident that happened to your body has caused your humours to go into an unbalanced state. And so what we need to do now is, for example, have a whole series of episodes of bloodletting to restore your humoral balance. And that is your treatment. So that would be an example. The other thing I'd like to mention in terms of resistance is I think we can't underestimate the key significance of the arrival of the plague for all of this thinking, because the plague could not be explained in terms of humoral balance and the individual disposition of a person according to the state of their body, because everyone witnessed how plague was affecting absolutely all kinds of people in all states of health at all moments in their life cycle as well. And so I think that was a key moment in terms of other forms of thinking coming into play about illness and how the body achieved a state of health.
The medieval church obviously had a huge role to play in this period. What was their sort of response to these ideas? Did they have a particular take on it at all?
They did. So religious communities and monastic communities played a key role in the dissemination of knowledge and practice relating to health. So alongside these ancient concepts of how the body functioned and how states of health were achieved, was a core set of principles about how the health of the body related to the health of the soul. And ultimately, the idea that if your soul was unwell or sick, your body would be sick, and that you needed to, therefore, focus above all on the health of your soul, which helps to, I guess, justify or explain the involvement of religious men and women in the treatment of illness. I think the other reason that that was so prominent was that monasteries were centres of learning, particularly in the earlier periods, so say the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. And so they were the places where texts were copied, where men and women who took religious vows had the opportunity to study and learn. And they were also self-sufficient communities where religious people needed to take care of each other in those communities and have medical expertise. The area that's really interesting, I think, is the area of magic and ritual. Medieval recipe collections, so collections of remedies, often contain certain remedies that have magical elements to them, but that also, more often than not, will also have a religious component. So it might be an appeal to saints, but that it has a ritualistic element to it that is clearly unorthodox in religious settings. And that, I think, is the area where the church sort of grappled. You might, for example, find a manuscript where those magical remedies have been crossed out. So someone at some point has found them highly problematic. At the same time, there's really interesting evidence for how magical practices were performed within some monasteries. So it's not clear that the two areas, so Christian medical care and magical medical treatments, were not totally distinct from each other at all. So that's the really interesting area. And I think that's an area that is very intriguing for us today.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Are you able to perhaps tell us about a case where you've got the intersection of the magical, religious, and the actual healthcare side of it?
A really useful example would be to think about medieval birthing girdles. So these were parchment rolls that were available probably to the more elite women, and they could be wrapped around the body during pregnancy and childbirth. And they were considered to provide protection and to have a potency that was derived from the words and the images inscribed on them. Above all, when you look at them, they do appear to be devotional objects. So they will have images of maybe the five wounds of Christ, or of saints such as St. Margaret. They will also have sequences of Maltese crosses, which are kind of instructive about performing the sign of the cross in relation to wearing this role on the body. But they also have magical elements. So possibly incantations written on them that involve words that are recognisably magical, possibly don't clearly make sense. Also diagrams of amulets that are more magical than Orthodox Christian. And I think they tap into a whole aspect of oral culture that was performative and had ritual aspects that, on the one hand, tapped into devotional behaviour, but on the other hand, had magical elements. And I think also thinking about the ideas that underlay how these birthing roles could be effective represent an intersection, I think, of religious and magical thinking.
Now, while we're on the topic of this, talking about childbirth and fertility, we've had a question from Jess Dickey on Facebook, who's asked about the medieval methods of improving fertility. Could you tell us about this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to see this question because I think fertility is something that's very much there in our modern day society and is recognised as something that was of great concern to medieval women and men. And so I guess the first thing to say is that medieval medical authors did grapple with this question. More often than not, they paid attention to how women's bodies might be the reason for the lack of conception rather than men's, which is something, you know, to really think about. I think one thing it's really helpful to see, I guess, is that people had strategies. So if they had the resources, they would obtain particular remedies from an apothecary that were specialised and were believed to promote fertility. So there is an example. So occasionally we have documents that tell us more about this. Anne of Bohemia, who was the queen of Richard II of England, they married very young and she didn't successfully bear a child. And she died pretty young during a plague outbreak. And in the 1390s, her household accounts show that she was procuring from an apothecary a range of herbal remedies, including plants such as plantain, and also a very expensive remedy called theriac, which was a whole amalgamation of different plants and minerals and animal substances that had a whole range of purposes, but clearly in this instance was understood to promote fertility. So that's an example of one woman who had the resources and the means to procure those kinds of remedies. In other settings, I would say that women and men would have done what they could to procure remedies, but they would have also endeavoured to procure the help of the saints as well. So St. Margaret, for example, was associated with fertility and successful pregnancies. So there's one example from late medieval England of a woman instructing her husband to wear a ring of St. Margaret, which historians have suggested is to do with ensuring that her pregnancy would be successful.
So continue on this theme. What was the medieval childbirth experience like at this time? Who was in the room?
Yeah, so that's something that is definitely really interesting to think about, again, in relation to how women experience childbirth today in what is usually a very medicalized setting. So almost all women in the Middle Ages gave birth at home, in the birthing room, in one of the rooms of the household that, or possibly the sole room of the household that was made over for that particular moment at that time. So the only women who would give birth in a hospital were women who were in a vulnerable social situation, who might be very poor, who might be single unmarried women, who did not have a domestic setting in which to give birth. And so that's something that I think is quite different for us to think about. So in the household setting, the woman would be attended by probably a group of midwives who would have a great deal of expertise in delivery and in caring for both the mother and the infant. There would also be other women from her household or her community supporting her. Physicians were very rarely present, but there is some evidence for their presence in very elite scenarios. Or possibly we can kind of imagine them outside the door of the room, but being called in if it was felt appropriate.
How did they deal with complications? Obviously, I think we hear about women dying in childbirth a lot in this period. How did they deal with that? What were their methods of perhaps prevention?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. There was high mortality from childbirth. And I think, so this exactly the same kinds of complications as those that arise today would arise then. So, for example, the presentation of the fetus in a position that wasn't the best one for giving birth. So I think their experience was absolutely key. So midwives who had experience in manipulating the child inside the womb would do that. So the other thing to think about as well, so if in the worst case scenario, a mother died during childbirth, there is evidence that cesarean sections were sometimes performed. It's hard to say how frequently that happened because I think there would need to be someone with surgical expertise able to do that. But there is evidence that it was sometimes performed. Now, the other side of the scenario of a very difficult situation would be if they had identified that the child was no longer living. So there are a number of herbal remedies that were understood to kind of help the mother to expel the infant at that point. They would, you know, basically treat it like a normal delivery, but obviously it would be a very, very difficult situation. And midwives were also empowered to baptize a child if they were born and it was clear that they needed to be baptized quickly. So I guess the other thing to say in terms of the mortality of mothers is that it was the period immediately after birth that was also incredibly risky in terms of infection. So that whole period of a number of days after the birth, there are instances of women who had sort of clearly sadly died during that period. Yeah. And obviously that's, yeah, coming back to this core threat that infection posed.
Thank you. We had so many questions on that. So one from Susan Kane on Facebook and some from Instagram as well. So I thought it's definitely a topic worth delving into. Now, we've spoken a little bit about midwives and physicians, but if we were in the medieval period, if you and I were there, who would we expect to be treated by?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is probably not a doctor usually. So doctors' services were very expensive. And also, in many instances, I think you'd be pretty sort of certain that they wouldn't be necessarily the right person, much as I think today you wouldn't go to your GP with a dental problem, you'd go to your dentist. So there was a range of practitioners with specialisms. So barber surgeons are a really interesting group because they were much more omnipresent, their services were less expensive, and they were skilled in doing a number of hands-on things. So physicians generally didn't touch the body. They might touch you to take your pulse, but usually they were kind of advising you and hearing your case history and so forth. A barber surgeon would do a number of things such as stitching a wound, cutting your hair, applying a plaster, many things that were involved close contact with the body. And those individuals were very important and might, you know, have their own specialisms. And there might be people with very niche specialisms, such as pulling out teeth, for example. Not a nice thing, but people who were known to be good at that, which would be quite important to have someone who is good at that.
NCOS on Instagram has asked about whether women were allowed to practice medicine. And I guess part of the follow-up question to that question would be, did wise women really exist? We hear a lot about them in sort of the popular interpretations of the Middle Ages, but is that true in real life?
Yeah, so I think it's really crucial to think about women as medical practitioners because women ultimately had the biggest responsibility for the care of the body. Whether or not that was as a recognised medical practitioner, and there were important recognised female practitioners, or within the household, and having responsibility for things like the laundering of clothes, or the preparation of food, or preparing the bodies of deceased household members for burial, which is something that women did. Women's kind of really close contact with bodies is the most evident sort of aspect for me. And for me, even if a woman wasn't necessarily labelled as a practitioner or practising some form of profession, women had multiple caregiving and medical roles. But there were women who had interesting practitioner roles. So women could not go to university and study medicine in the way that men could. And that actually meant that when they were practising in the marketplace, they could be potentially more vulnerable to accusations about their good conduct or their knowledge or their expertise, you know, particularly if, and this might well happen in a medical situation, something went wrong. So there's also evidence that women and also men practiced kind of at the margins of the profession. So we're doing things that might be seen as really kind of inappropriate or, for example, procuring the flesh of deceased people to convert into ointments to treat skin ailments. There are some interesting cases from late medieval Paris of court cases where women were prosecuted for doing this kind of thing. There's something about a female practitioner who is an empirical practitioner. She doesn't have formal education. She might be quite itinerant. She might travel around with potentially a box of medicines. She is known for her expertise and she's respected and she's called upon, and particularly in emergency situations. And she's someone that you can get hold of and she's not going to cost the earth. So she's quite a crucial figure. You might be hopeful that you could call that well-known physician from two towns away, but even getting the message to him is difficult and it's going to bankrupt your family finances for the next 2 years. So call that woman because she she's local, she can help. And the family two houses down called upon her 2 weeks ago and she helped them. And many of those women won't have left any trace in the historical record necessarily.
So you've spoken about a range of expertise there. I don't suppose you could talk a little bit about the training. How did people acquire this medical knowledge?
Absolutely. I think it's really important to think about a range of different contexts for learning. Today, I think a useful analogy would be the apprenticeship, training on the job, basically, and having access to someone who has great expertise, who can tell you how things work, can share nuanced knowledge. So, for example, for me, that birthing room with that group of midwives, I think that's probably going to involve one or two senior midwives who've attended many births and have seen all kinds of scenarios, and then probably three or four much more junior ones who need to learn. So they need to be there and they can help and they can do useful things in that situation, all kinds of things. But they also need to be there so that they witness and they see that sometimes that thing happens, sometimes another thing happens. Sometimes that remedy works, sometimes it backfires. So I think apprenticeships would also have been really important in apothecary shops. So for understanding the properties of medications and side effects, which I think would have been something to think about, as well as, you know, I'm sure that, so we today think about allergies, you know, are you allergic to aspirin or paracetamol? In the Middle Ages, there would have been awareness that some people took that remedy and had a very bad reaction. So they would have also been asking about case histories, and training would have involved knowing how to work with patients as well. So I think it's interesting to think about physicians in that light, because university learning of medicine was all based on studying texts and learning them and writing commentaries on them. But physicians would also need to get to know how to work with patients. So ultimately, they needed to go through a kind of apprenticeship phase as well. I think there's a lot about learning on the job, gaining experience, and being part of a community of practitioners so that you could ask your fellow practitioners for their advice about particular problems.
There's so much fascinating stuff in there that I'd really like to touch upon. Before we do that, I've just got a quick question from No Idea One on Instagram. He's asked about the significance of Islamic scholars and physicians in medieval medicine.
It's really important to think about the context of learning from the Middle East in the medical frame of Europe. So I'm really grateful for that question. So texts in Arabic were translated into Latin, particularly in the course of the 12th century. And that was a route for the transmission of ancient medical learning through into medieval learning. So it was absolutely crucial. And what had happened for a range of reasons was that the ancient Greek medical texts had not survived in their original form, but they had been translated into Arabic. And so those Arabic texts, once translated into Latin, which was the learned language of Europe, then became available. So all that knowledge about the humours, about the non-naturals, about many other key areas of understanding of the body were transmitted via that route. The other thing to say is that practitioners from the Middle East are also known to have been present in Europe, providing their expertise and sharing practices and techniques. So that Middle Eastern context is really important.
Now, we've spoken a lot about the practitioners, but what about the patients themselves? Who actually had access to said treatment? We've touched on it a bit here and there. How did location, gender, social status all dictate what sort of treatment you'd receive?
All those factors really shaped the experience that you would have as a patient. So in terms of social status, it's very much about access. So access in terms of being able to pay for your treatments in a situation when there was no national health service at all, access in terms of having the knowledge to know who to go to and how to reach them. But also, I think questions around how much knowledge you would have yourself of your body to know what to seek help with as well. And I think the gender question that comes in terms of different scenarios where women would feel comfortable, for example, even within the domestic frame, to sort of say to their husbands, look, I've got this problem and I need you to talk to a physician on my behalf about this problem that is, you know, something that actually she might not feel comfortable talking about, for example. In terms of location, I think rural versus urban is a huge distinction. So in an urban setting, you've got access to apothecaries. For example, you might have a marketplace where there are two or three different apothecaries and you go and ask all of them, you know, and get all of their advice and then decide which one to go on. In a rural setting, the resources available to you are much more limited. But at the same time, you might have a more close-knit community that supported you in that way. There was a huge amount of localized variation across Europe. Some towns and cities in, for example, Germany and Italy had kind of civic doctors who would advise the town government on things like plague outbreaks. Other parts of Europe really didn't have that. So they didn't have that kind of municipal expertise, I guess, available. And also, I think it's important to bear in mind that sort of daily life could become very disrupted very easily. So in situations of food shortages or conflict, the fabric of society would be very disrupted and the whole system for accessing medical treatment would really potentially break down.
I'd like to ask you a bit about the medieval first aid kit, as it were. Now, we've got this question from Andre Cito, 83 on Instagram, who's asked, was it as heavy on the leeches as we're led to believe?
Yeah, so leeches, that they are quite a vivid thing to think about. I think the first aid kit we can think of as something that might have all kinds of things in it, actually. And that really speaks to the sophistication of medieval healthcare. So I would think of things like pieces of linen or hemp that could be used as bandages or plasters. I like to think there might be a pot of honey, because honey was clearly recognized as being really beneficial. And we know now that it's a very useful kind of barrier for wounds and it has antimicrobial properties. So I think that might well be there, as well as being something that was clearly used to sweeten treatments that you would take orally. So to sweeten that drink so that you could take it. And in terms of drinks, I think there would be vials of distilled medicinal waters in that first aid kit as well, as remedies that were portable and could be easily taken. But I think there might have been other kinds of objects. So I think you could think of devotional objects as having their place in a first aid kit. So I've mentioned birthing rolls, which when they were rolled up were very small. And you might well think of one of those tucked in the corner of the first aid kits, or indeed a relic or something that potentially the practitioner who owned that first aid kit might want to carry with them to give them some good fortune in administering treatments. But coming back to leeches, so leeches, for me, yes, they were used sometimes. They're part of a repertoire of techniques for bloodletting. So they relate to this core idea that taking blood from the body would help to restore the balance of the humours, and would therefore be a really useful medical treatment. And this was both as a regular treatment. So in monastic communities, definitely bloodletting would be performed 4 or 5 times a year, but also as a specific intervention when someone was unwell. The letting of blood from the veins, the application of leeches, cupping, which applied heated glass vessels to the surface of the skin to draw the blood to the surface. Also scarification, which was a kind of variation on the specific kind of taking blood from the veins. So for me, it's part of a range of techniques. I don't think it was ubiquitous, but interestingly, leeches are used today, I believe, in some contexts, medicinally. So something that, well, today I think bloodletting is not seen as something that's beneficial. Leeches have some uses, I believe.
So in a similar vein, Jennifer on Facebook has asked about the herbs and spices used. What herbs and spices were used?
Yeah, a whole range of plants, spices, animal substances, mineral substances were used to create medications. I almost want to say, you know, name your plant, you might well find it's been used in a medieval treatment, to be honest. Some of them that stand out, so I think one that is prominent in remedy collections and has quite a lot of sort of associations even today, I think, is the plant pennyroyal, that is known to have purgative effects, and in particular that can cause the lining of the uterus to shed. So pennyroyal is seen in gynecological treatments, and often it's presented as to induce menstruation or to encourage the delivery of an infant. But reading between the lines, it was used as an abortive remedy, as an abortifacient, so to bring about an abortion. But it was almost always considered not possible to say that explicitly in a medical text. But the way that the treatments are described sort of makes that clear. Another plant, rue, has similar properties, and that one also appears quite frequently. So saffron appears, for example. Interestingly, you quite often have plants appearing, for example, in 15th century English remedy collections that were not indigenous to England. So we think about the trade in plant substances. So the fact that potentially some substances were travelling long distances to reach the marketplace and be available. But also that I think in a household context as well, people would substitute plants or other substances. So they would say, okay, so saffron's been recommended because it's hot and dry. So what plant do I have in my garden that has those properties? And maybe I'm going to try that. So something about adaptation and flexibility, which you can also think about in terms of something that often people say when looking at medieval recipes is, well, where are the measurements? So how do I know how much of this plant to put in? Because no, it doesn't say so. And I think there's something there about orally transmitted knowledge and experience, but also some flexibility there as well. And in terms of other types of substances, gold is mentioned sometimes, the most kind of expensive of minerals. In terms of animal substances, so all sorts of things. So milk and honey, human substances, so breast milk, human excrement sometimes. So sort of also really interesting to think about what was acceptable, what was actually used, how people got hold of things as well, in a practical sense.
Were treatments widely known, or were they more localised, perhaps to a village or a community?
So treatments could definitely be very localised, particularly if you had one of these empirical practitioners who had that remedy that they had, in effect, patented, not officially, but they knew how to make it, and they didn't share that widely. And people knew that it worked. So that could be very localised. It could also be something that knowledge could spread. So if you think about marketplaces in different towns, and that one practitioner might sort of go to one week and go to another the next week. And so it's sort of localised, but in a slightly broader network of a region. But also, we have some remedies that are clearly kind of transnational across Europe. So some remedy collections that are translated into different languages, so that are originally in Latin and then they're translated into French, Italian, English, Dutch. So those remedies are known about in a wide range of contexts. They might be adapted locally and maybe combined with local remedies, but they travel more widely.
Speaking about things like adaptations to perhaps a known recipe or a passed on recipe, do we know of perhaps any dodgy discoveries or things where they went wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that, so from legal records, it's clear that things went wrong. So physicians were vulnerable to cases being brought against them. However, in that legal setting, I guess in any kind of legal dispute, there'll be two sides. And a physician could argue that, well, that patient was already extremely sick and I was trying to do something to help them. But, you know, there was only so much I could do. In many instances, it wouldn't be clear that the treatment had kind of killed them. There were some treatments that we know really wouldn't have been effective. For example, there was a cataract treatment that involved a surgical intervention to move the cataract to a different part of the eye. And I think there were testimonies that the cataract would then come back, and it would. So those kinds of treatments. In terms of really dangerous remedies, at the very end of the Middle Ages, mercury started to be used, particularly for treatments of the pox, which was equivalent to modern-day syphilis, which suddenly appeared in European communities at the very end of the 15th century. And mercury did have adverse effects that were immediately observed. But much as I've just been talking about, you know, the fuzziness about the outcome of a medical treatment, there wasn't necessarily an immediate recognition that mercury was dangerous because those patients were already very ill. So, you know, was it the mercury that was causing these horrible side effects, or was it their illness that the mercury wasn't ultimately successful in treating?
I think there's also this perception of medieval treatment, maybe perhaps even the sort of the surgical element of it, being quite gruesome as well. And like you're talking about dealing with cataracts there, it doesn't sound like a particularly pleasant treatment, to be honest. Could you tell us more about this reality of this?
Very few medieval surgical instruments survive, but we do have surgical instruments from the slightly later period that, you know, when you do see them, for example, in museum collections, it can cause you some alarm seeing these quite barbaric looking objects. I guess the thing to say is that surgical techniques were potentially quite violent, but they were used in a very considered way. And much as very few people had access to physicians, I think relatively few people would have had access to those kinds of surgical treatments. And the people who did have access would have been in consultation with the surgeon, you know, advising them about whether or not to carry out this treatment. I think the risks were fully recognised in terms of, you know, the extent to which a patient could be anaesthetised and the risk of infection, and ultimately the extent to which an intervention would bring about any improvement or recovery. So I think it's an area where, yes, the instruments existed, yes, the techniques and the knowledge existed, but was this done all the time? Absolutely not. And I think also in terms of that sense of gruesomeness, we can kind of look at the two sides of the coin, I guess. So you've got those instruments, those methods, that sort of need to do things that we might consider to be quite extreme and highly risky today, on the one hand. And on the other hand, much evidence for a really nuanced understanding of health. So I think advice literature about, for example, the medieval diets just shows how much careful attention people could pay to exactly what they ate and drank, the seasonality of food, the properties of particular animal products and so forth. It shows a sensitivity and a care that suggests that people did know what they were going in for, you know, and would really think about it and be really careful about it. And, you know, took responsibility for their health and that of people around them. And themselves would have seen these things as pretty horrible, but occasionally necessary in their eyes.
Now I'm curious, what was the ideal medieval diets?
So the first thing I get to say is that they didn't have some of the things that we really like today. So, you know, so they weren't worrying about too much chocolate or too much coffee or too much tea. So it was foodstuffs that were fresh and balanced in a humoral sense. So dairy products, chicken was often seen as something that was really beneficial. So in hospitals, often the diet for the sick was chicken soup, and also vegetables and moderation of other meat, and fish was seen as very healthy as well. So oily fish, which is something that we recognise today as well as being generally a good thing.
Oh, that's really interesting. I think I've got another question I wanted to touch on, drawing from your answer about the gruesomeness almost of medieval medicine, and that's just about painkillers. I know you're talking about people being anaesthetised, but did they have any effective form of pain relief?
So they had some things they could do. So alcohol was recognised as something that would relieve pain and potentially could be used to basically knock someone out. They used alcohol for sure. They used distilled forms of alcohol, so something called aqua ardens, which was the sort of, you know, concentrated alcoholic substance. There's also, so opiates existed, so the use of poppy seed to create medications that would relieve pain. And there were various devices for administering anaesthetic. So for example, quite a few medical authors write about sponges that were kind of infused with an analgesic substance, and then it could be kind of released in a very controlled way from the sponge into potentially the nostrils or onto the body and onto a kind of localized area. We're not totally sure how much those sponges were actually used, but they are definitely written about. So there were techniques, but obviously I think today we take for granted that you can have an anaesthetic that makes you absolutely unaware of the pain. And I think you couldn't take that for granted in the Middle Ages. So going into any surgical situation would have had all of that attached to it, and indeed childbirth as well.
I really want to ask you this because I'm quite intrigued. In your work and research and reading, what would you say is the strangest medieval cure that you've found or seen or come across?
And that's where I think there's a really, really interesting interface between us and our ancestors, I guess. Because I do come across things and I just think that's just really odd. Or it's just sort of, you know, how could that have made sense? Or how could that have been considered to work? But clearly it did make sense. And clearly it had an effect. And it might be that it has an effect that provides reassurance or is part of a whole web of interventions that ultimately bring about a change in someone's condition. So a couple of examples would be magical healing charms for epilepsy, which often in some way involve children, whether it's there was particular anxiety about what was called the falling sickness in children. And often in some ways, children were kind of implemented in the treatments. So one of them that is found in some manuscripts involves taking blood from the little finger of a child's hand and mixing that with other substances to create a remedy. And why would it be the little finger? You know, and why would it be a child's hand, etc.? But clearly there was a whole system of thinking around that. There was also, I came across something, it was really less of a treatment and more of just a device, I guess, which is something that we now are able to find this out, but this is incredibly recent in human history, is how to determine if a woman is expecting a boy or a girl. And it involves her taking a range of drinks and then going to sit down. And if she, I think it was something very detailed about if she puts her right hand down first, it's a girl. And if she puts her left hand down first, it's a boy. So, but, you know, so it's a combination of things that she consumes and then her actions. And that is understood to be evidence. But it's also a suggestion of, I think, the need to know and the need to do things and how that in itself could provide the reassurance, whether it's to continue to have a healthy pregnancy or whether it's to be less anxious that your child will suffer from the falling sickness. Or so I think many of us, if we go on holiday, we will take a pack of paracetamol. Even if we're traveling to a country that we know sells paracetamol, we will have it in our suitcase. And I think we might feel somehow less likely to have a headache while we're away or to be in pain because we've got it. You know, it's a kind of insurance policy. It's backup. It reassures us. And I think that's a key aspect of health that I think we can relate to the way that people were managing their health in the Middle Ages.
As a final question to you, I've got a question here from Joyous Occasions Food on Instagram. And they've asked, are there any cures, practices, beliefs, I guess we can extend that to rituals, traditions from the medieval period that we still have or use today?
Yeah, so the answer is definitely. And I think that also is helpful for us in thinking about what is that kind of relationship that we have with these practices? And, you know, are they actually that strange or different? We've all had this really difficult experience over the past 4 years with epidemic illness since the pandemic. And for me, as a historian of medieval health, that was a really striking moment for thinking about what we do now and what they did then. So medieval understanding of plague and prevention was all about miasmatic air, so corrupt air and how you must avoid breathing it. And you must avoid being in crowds of people, or on a most obvious level, avoid any proximity to someone who might have contracted the illness. And I think we were in a situation where that was, before the vaccine arrived, that was the only thing that we could do. And it really brought us back to that place that that people had experienced in the 14th and 15th centuries of not being able to just take a pill and make it go away, because that wasn't how we could deal with that situation. The other thing to say is that there is really exciting research at the moment, and that hopefully will increase in the future, that looks at the plants in medieval remedies and thinks about how they could be used for modern day treatments, because people use those plants time and again to treat illness. And so they may well have properties that could be incredibly beneficial, and that really in modern day pharmacology could really be harnessed in really, really significant ways. And the final thing I would say on that note is to come back to these core concepts and how people strategize to stay healthy. And that was in terms of paying careful attention to their diet and the amount of exercise they had, the amount of sleep they had, and their emotional well-being. And I think those are all things that we really prioritise today. So for me, that's another key connection.
That was Elma Brenner, specialist in medieval and early modern medicine at the Wellcome Library. To find out more about some strange treatments for medieval maladies, then be sure to listen to our episode on medieval medical recipes with James Freeman. You can find that by searching for Curious Cures on your podcast feeds or our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.